This is session two of Modern Closed Circuit Television Design. In this session, we're going to talk about the television camera internals, not including the enclosure. A lens gathers light from the scene in front of it and squeezes it down to a clear image on the sensor. This is a standard textbook image, usually demonstrating film. You have a person standing on the right, a large glass lens in the middle, and an inverted image on the left, smaller than the lens and on a piece of film behind the lens. And usually there's a line from the top of his head through the lens to the top of his head, which is at the bottom of the film, from his feet through the lens to his feet, which are at the top of the film. Well, this is what's going on inside a CCTV camera, except for the fact that we're talking about a very small pickup. A 1/3 inch pickup is the standard sensor for a TV camera. 35 millimeter camera obviously has a 35 millimeter sensor. The 35 millimeter film is about 1.5 inches wide, which is considerably larger than 1/3 of an inch. Anyway, how big the lens is determines how much light comes in. The maximum lens opening is called the aperture. It's a measure of the lens. The adjustment of the aperture is done by iris control. Now, iris is an internal shutter inside the lens. Sometimes it's in a spiral form, so it starts with a big circle that lets all the light in, and the circle gets smaller till just a pinpoint of light gets into it. Looks something like the doorways in science fiction movies. The other form of aperture control is a framing shutter, where it's a big square thing that goes down to a smaller square thing. But again, limits the amount of light coming through. And we'll see in a moment why that's important. Note that an auto iris lens, that's where a motor drives the lens, motor drives the iris, closes. It lets no light through when it's disconnected, and it cannot be used without the DC cable connected. So there's a big difference between an auto iris lens and a manual iris lens. For film cameras, the aperture, the size of the lens, is very important. For CCD cameras, the CCD sensors in CCTV cameras, it's often not even mentioned in the advertisement. And the reason is we're using a 1/3 inch diameter sensor, which is roughly 8 millimeters across. For a 35 millimeter lens, that's 35 millimeters up and down, or about 50 millimeters across. Anyway, it takes about 64 times as much glass to make a decent lens for a 35 millimeter camera. The cost difference between an F1.4 lens, which is a very good, very fast lens, and an F8 lens, which is a very conventional lens in a 35 millimeter camera, it's no cost at all in CCTV, and it may be a couple hundred dollars on a 35 millimeter camera. Most unlabeled CCTV lenses are f1.4, f2.0. Again, we're not going to talk in detail what this means. If you want to get into some photographic literature, you can, but those are fast lenses. In CCTV, low light sensitivity is a feature of the sensor, not a feature of the lens. That is, does it work at night? Well, that depends on what's in the guts of the camera, not how much lens you put on it. Just the opposite on 35 millimeter. Choosing a CCTV lens means choosing the focal length, that is, number in millimeter that says what image it makes, whether it's trying to make an image of something very far away and fill the CCD, or something up close and fill the CCD. The iris control, and the fixed or varifocal or zoom type of lens. Focal length determines the field of view. In the written version, we emphasize the abbreviations that are used because we're expecting you're going to research it in a literature or written form. So field of view is FOV. In the oral form, we won't talk much about FOV, but if you see that when you're reading something about it, that's what we're talking about. Field of view is what do you see with the lens? And that sounds silly the first time you approach it, but the more you think about it, the more you think this is absolutely critical. You've probably got one place where it's convenient to mount the camera. You don't have that much choice. You may have two choices to choose between, but you don't have an unlimited number of choices. There's a a good place to mount it where your wire runs easily and where it has a good view and nobody can reach it to smash it. Okay, you got to put the camera there and you want to see that thing over there. Now, you got to be very precise. What is the thing over there? If you want to see whether somebody comes through the door, chances are you want something like a 10-foot vertical field of view. You want to see the person and you want to get enough of the door so you can see whether he fills the doorway or he half fills the doorway. You get some measure of the height of the guy and you can see a little bit of what's going on there. If you want to see if somebody puts their hand in the cash box, then you want to focus in on a 10-inch portion of the cash box on the cash register. The reason I mentioned this is I was just watching a documentary where they were recording a clerk stealing from his employer, and the reason he pled guilty when they took him into court was because they had pictures of him taking it out of the cash box. Now, to do that, and this starts getting into the complication of the whole system, you'd want one camera showing who's putting their hand in the cash box and another picture showing what he's doing in the cash box. And he's taking out a lot of 20s. I mean, that's not, in any event, the field of view or the millimeters focal length of the camera is a key distinction. It's a key thing you must specify, and you must specify it right if it's going to work right. With a couple workarounds we'll get into in a minute. I've got a table here, and again, tables don't work well in the oral version, so I'm going to give you the important parts of the table and urge you to look at the entire table if you're interested in the intermediate values. What this table is different lenses you can buy compared with field of view. What do you buy? What do you get? Sounds right, and it's a fairly big table. It goes from 2.97 millimeters, which is called a wide-angle lens, and it's a cheap, readily available wide-angle lens. The second one on the list is 3.6. 3.6 is very important because that's the one that's usually shipped with a camera if they don't say anything. It's considered a standard wide-angle lens. Oh my gosh, it's standard, it's wide-angle, it's standard wide-angle. Everybody ships it, so it's standard, but it is a wide-angle lens. So 3.6 has some special meaning. Then the numbers get bigger. They get like 6 millimeters, 8 millimeters, 12 millimeters, 25 millimeters, 50 millimeters, 75 millimeters. I am just going to talk about two lenses in the oral version of this course because this covers all the concepts involved. And if you want something intermediate, you can look at the table or just choose something intermediate on your own. The two lenses I'm going to talk about are the 2.97 millimeter or 3 millimeter because it's a very special lens that it's a wide angle lens with a 90 degree field of view. Now, again, think about your camera hanging under the eaves spout. You're going to be able to see 90 degrees in front of you. I mean, that is more than the human eye can see in front of you. So this is going to pick up everything that's happening in front of the camera. And that's what wide angle means. It will not pick it up in great detail. But if you're interested in if somebody is coming across your parking lot, it will tell you somebody's coming across your parking lot or coming across your field or coming up the steps into the courthouse. I mean, this wide angle lens does exactly what it does, and it does it very well. The other lens I'd like to talk about is a 5-50 varifocal lens. Now, why would I choose such a common answer before the question, not fair. Why would I choose such a complicated lens as an example? Because it is a common lens. It is an inexpensive lens. It's readily available. Almost all vendors will provide it with your camera, and it solves so many, many problems. It's 5-50 millimeters. At the 5 millimeter end, it's called a telephoto lens. I mean, it is a little more telephoto than the standard lens shipped with the cheapest camera, but not very telephoto. It's actually if you insist on using the word telephoto, let's say short telephoto or portrait lens. At the 50 millimeter end of its adjustment, it's a pretty decent telephoto lens. The reason I dug out this table and I worked on this table, I added some information to it. We had a problem that it was very important to get a good image of the electric gate at the edge of the property. The electric gate was opened by a button and then was closed by a button, and they had a problem of closing the gate on cars driving through it. And the guy that ran the place, he was real upset. Can't they see the gates closing and either stop and wait or go a little faster and beat it? But no, they let the thing drive into the side of their cars. So he wanted a picture of the gate closing so he could stop it manually if there was somebody sitting there looking at the gate looking real unhappy. And the question was, what size lens do you use on the camera? And that was fairly easy to do. I had a drawing of the property, and I determined there were two cameras that we could hook up this way. One was 100 feet away, and the other was 300 feet away. So I want to get the picture of this gate from 100 feet away. What lens do I use? I want to get a picture of the gate from 300 feet away. What lens do I use? And so I go to the table, and at 100 feet, the horizontal field of view of a 50 millimeter lens is 10 feet. Well, hey, that's a little more than a car length. Because this gate was a little more than two lanes wide, at 25 millimeters, the field of view is 20 feet. Okay, now you say, I thought we were just doing 50 millimeter guy. No, we're doing varifocal. So it does everything between 5 millimeters and 50 millimeters. So at the low end, the 5 millimeter would give me a 77-foot field of view at 100 feet. Well, 77, there's going to be a lot of cars there. That's not going to tell us much about what's happening at the gate. The 20-foot field of view on the 25-millimeter position, which is halfway down the varifocal adjustment, that's keen. The 10-foot would be usable. You'd have to be very careful how you adjusted it. You'd have to arrange that no birds fly into it. The wind never blows. So I would say the 5 to 50 millimeter lens would work great. You'd probably want to adjust it a little over the scene size, so you're seeing a little more than you have to, so that when things jiggle in the wind, you don't have to go up and readjust it. Okay, that's the 100-foot application. What happens at 300 foot? Well, it turns out that the 50 millimeter has a 30-foot view, a horizontal field of view, at 300 feet. And that's not good enough because this thing is probably about 20 feet wide. The 25 millimeter we were talking about from 100 feet is a good choice. What are we going to do if 50 millimeter only gives us 30 feet field of view? We want to get it down to 20 feet. Well, we're going to have some number bigger than 50 millimeters. And that answers the question. You're not going to be able to use a standard lens. You're going to have to get a special lens that's bigger than 50 millimeters. So those two examples are pretty nice. Let's look at the low end. I like the idea of 5 feet away because a lot of places I visit, they have a closed-circuit camera right over the cash register. And I'm always wondering, are they watching the clerk working the cash register or are they watching the customer signing the form on the counter? Well, if it's 5 feet away, which is these cameras I walk into in the gas stations and fast food stores, what is a 3.6 millimeter lens seeing at 5 foot? Well, it's seeing a field of view of 5.2 feet. Now you think 5.2 feet, you can have quite a group of people there and it's still picking up all of them. In the someplace I made a joke about the entire basketball team would be picked up by a 3.6 millimeter lens 5 feet from the field of, or 5 feet from the image you're trying to pick up. So 3.6 is a real nice wide angle lens. And again, this is the standard lens that's shipped on standard cameras if you're looking at the price and you're not looking at the specifications. And even if you are, if they don't say anything, you can be pretty sure you're getting a 3.6 millimeter lens. A very good wide angle lens works very good for close pictures. Does not work good for distant pictures. Now let's talk again about this fast food store where they've got the camera over the cash register. And there's a cooler at the back of the store. Well, you're going to know there's a cooler at the back of the store because you've been in there, but you're not going to be able to see the doors on it. You're not going to be able to see if the underage customer takes out a bottle of beer or a bottle of milk. It just will not show up on a 3.6 millimeter lens. If that's something you want to watch, you're going to need, and again, I'd recommend the varifocal because you can keep trying intermediate positions so you find one you like. But you will be able to find something that zooms in on the head and the hand so you can see who it is and what he's holding in his hands. In a fixed camera, this works very, very well. Again, you might want to have two cameras, one for wide angle, one for telephoto. This is a story you're going to be hearing again and again. I would prefer to put in two cameras than pan, tilt, zoom, just because it's so inexpensive and so easy today to record two channels. So you can see what's going on, and you can see what he's got in his hand, and there's no fooling around. You come back the next day or at the end of the month, and you know who it was and what he had in his hands because you had two cameras installed. The table below was expanded from a published table by correcting some errors and adding the 100 and 300 foot columns, and it also has rows for 25 millimeter, 50 millimeter, and 75 millimeter lenses, which were not in the original table. The original table was intended for fixed lenses, and yes, you can get these long telephotos in fixed lenses, but they're actually more common in varifocals, and I recommend them. A marvelous insight from the table is that a 3-millimeter lens, 2.97 I think I said, has a 90-degree field of view. Four 3-point-millimeter lenses produce a full panorama. With a little care, this arrangement permits four inexpensive fixed cameras to replace a pan, tilt, and zoom camera. And again, this is author's message. I have this fear of a pan, tilt, zoom camera. All the things it's not picking up. It does an excellent job picking up what it's picking up, but you don't know all the things it's not picking up. So you may be watching this guy walking across your yard and you're trying to figure out if he's carrying a knife or a gun or a bottle or, you know, what's in his hand, and the pan tilt zoom will do that for you. But you don't see four guys on a different path going in carrying a big box or going out carrying one of your big boxes. I mean, the pan tilt zoom does what it does very well, but it's also very, very limited. If you were to put in four 2.97 millimeter fixed cameras, you would see everything happening in the yard. You would not get facial features. You couldn't identify the person from a police lineup, but there wouldn't be something else happening in a different part of the yard you didn't know about. It would be 100% coverage from four of these fixed cameras $2,500 for a pan tilt zoom, $200 for four fixed cameras. I mean, wow. Okay, though. The comment in the original table that a 1/3-inch sensor is not the same as a 1/4-inch sensor is prejudice against the smaller sensor. As the course was being written, 1/3-inch CCDs are much better quality than 1/4-inch CCDs. So you don't want to get the small sensor in 2004. That is not to say you don't want to get the small sensor in 2005. Matter of fact, in 2004, Sony is selling a premium closed-circuit TV camera with a 1/4-inch sensor. And I just don't buy this prejudice. You don't throw out 1/4-inch sensor as a rule. You look at it to make sure that's what you want. Yes, the mainstream answer is buy a 1/3-inch. It's a better sensor. And mostly that's true. But not always that's true, and not certain in the future. The table has a note on it to use a 0.75 correction for use with a 1/4-inch sensor. Again, the table was made up for a 1/3-inch sensor. The cameras are made for 1/3-inch sensors. Generally, what that means is a specific lens puts a specific image on a 1/3-inch sensor. If the guy's gone cheap and put a 1/4-inch sensor in, he hasn't readjusted all the mountings and orientations, and what happens is he's just picking up 1/4-inch of the 1/3-inch image. So he is picking up 75% of the horizontal width, and the field of view will be 75% of the field of view. Once again, and this is probably one of the last things in the course, and not at all wrong to have it a first thing also, check out what the image looks like before you tighten the screws on it. I really, really like a varifocal lens because they're a little bit more money than the fixed lens, but you can adjust it to get exactly what you want. Darn it, I can't quite pick out. Well, if it's because you have too wide a field of view and you're not getting the resolution on varifocal, you can zoom in a little more. If it's because the space you want to see is a little wider than you can pick up with a lens, you can widen it out with a varifocal. It seems like an awfully good solution. Auto iris is a DC motor on the aperture control of the lens. The camera decides if it's getting too much light and tells the lens to stop down or reduce the light gathering. This never happens indoors, that is, unless you focus on a light source. Outside, daytime light levels vary from about 10,000 foot candles to about 100 foot candles. Auto iris has some value. Against this recommendation, our vendor claims that electronic shutters have 1/10,000th of a second, and this eliminates the need for the DC auto iris. Experience is that DC motors eventually fail. Mechanical linkages eventually fail. An auto iris camera is not going to have the reliability of an electronic shutter camera. Now, this is something you have to decide for yourself. I would listen very closely to advice from your vendor. If they can tell you he's got 300 of these installed down the street and they're working fine, that means you should call the guy down the street and see if you're hearing the straight story. If there are 300 of these working well down the street, that's a good installation for you. If he's installed them in the other part of the country and hasn't heard any complaints, that's not a real enthusiastic recommendation. Nighttime light levels vary from 100-foot candles directly under the fixture to about 1/100th of a foot candle where there's no fixture anywhere you can see it. The iris is always fully open under a low light level situation. The fixed lens discussion above refers to very varifocal lenses without elaboration. For the most part, this is acceptable. A good varifocal lens is essentially interchangeable for any fixed lens within its range. A 3-8 varifocal lens, a 3-8 millimeter varifocal lens, is a 90-degree lens, and a 32-degree lens, and every lens in between. This works because a 35mm negative has more than 10 megapixels of information, while a 1/3-inch CCD has about 0.3 megapixel of resolution. A film camera, the lens is the weak link. When the picture starts going bad, you can just about be sure it's the bad lens. A better lens will improve the quality of your picture. On a CCT camera, you've got a 525 by 300 standard, and you're never going to get any better than that. You can spend $10 on a lens, you can spend $100 on a lens, you can spend $1,000 on the lens. There will be no image improvement above the $10 lens. The weak point of the system is the standard it's feeding into, the scan rate that it has, the amplifiers on the video signal. The significant difference between varifocals and fixed lenses is physical size. A C-mount 3.6mm wide-angle, that is standard, lens is about 2 centimeters thick. A C-mount varifocal 5-50mm lens is about 6 millimeters thick. So it's three times as thick. And the numbers are becoming sizable if you're trying to put this in a small enclosure. Yeah, you got a big box a foot long. A couple centimeters doesn't make a difference. If you're trying to put it in a 2-inch mini dome, an extra 4 centimeters means it doesn't fit in the 2-inch mini dome. Board mount lenses for postage stamp cameras have the same ratio. I was talking about C-mount lenses that go on box cameras. Board mount lenses go on the postage stamp cameras. Telephoto varifocal lens will not fit in a standard mini dome enclosure. The technology of closed circuit television camera sensors is advancing very rapidly and will not be reviewed here. Note that the 525 by 300 standard limits image quality to something far below the capability of available sensors and electronics. Because of the tremendous inertia of the industry and widespread acceptance of commercial TV and HD TV, it's unlikely that high-resolution analog CCTV will grow rapidly. On the other hand, IPTV cameras are just being introduced in the 1600 to 1200 resolution. That means you can place your order today and get it next week, and you put it on your network, and you'll get a 1600 by 1200 picture on your computer screen. Prices are presently between $1,500 and $2,500 without weatherproof enclosure. They're compatible with 100 megabyte local area networks and compatible with IP digital video recorders and computer screens. I haven't done any research on the bandwidth requirements of these, but what's happening is the resolution is growing, at least in sample products, and the compression is improving maybe four times. Well, let's see. The difference between 320 by 240 camera and a 1600 by 1200 camera is some huge number, because it's some huge number wider and some huge number higher, and it's that huge number times the other huge number for the number of pixels and the bandwidth required. So it's going to take a whole heck of a lot of improvement in compression to keep the bandwidth requirement down. Light sensitivity is rated in lux. lux. A foot candle is 11 lux. 1 lux is a situation where the human eye can pick out forms but not avoid tripping over objects. All commercial TV cameras produce a decent picture at 1 lux. Below 1 lux, color cameras switch to black and white, and some stress is placed upon the sensor. Very ordinary cameras deliver an acceptable image of 0.1 lux on a dark night. Some are rated to deliver a picture at 0.03 lux, which is just a little bit of lighted haze in the sky. Infrared pickups, however, are available for at slight premium cost that promise to deliver an image from 30 feet away using little LEDs on the front of the camera in absolute darkness. Now, after I had written this and I was looking for illustrations, I found a Sony camera that claims 80-foot pickup in absolute darkness using its own IR illuminators right on the camera. And that just absolutely blows my mind. The power supply to a closed-circuit television camera is simple. But there are many alternatives, each with special benefits. Until recently, a conventional 120-volt AC outlet was called for in the above-ceiling space somewhere near the camera. When the security contractor came in, he plugged in a wall wart, one of those little transformer things, ran 12 volts DC or 20 volts AC on telephone wire to the camera. He then ran his video cable back to the control point. This is still commonly done, but it is usually illegal per the National Electric Code, and creates a reliability and maintenance problem later. The conventional method recommended by this course is a Siamese cable. That's made up of a video coax and 18/2 power conductors in an overall jacket, or a planar-rated jacket if it's in environmental aerospace. Now let's go through this again. Video coax is that little black cable about, not a quarter inch in diameter, almost always black. I've seen some white ones. And they have to go all the way from the camera to the control room. 18/2 is exactly the same thing as lamp cord. Now, they're using slightly different insulation, so it's not brown ribbed stuff. Usually they have a red one and a black one. But it's small copper conductors. The overall jacket means there's a cover like an extension cord over the power conductors and the coax. And actually, it's commercial coax, commercial power, and an additional jacket put on it at the time of fabrication. The coax by itself costs about $100 per 1,000 feet. RG59 coax with 18/2 in an overall jacket costs about $200 per 1,000 feet. So yeah, it costs money, but none of the cable costs have any significance compared with the labor. Remember, somebody has to work above the drop ceiling to make this happen. And the equipment on both ends is much, much more expensive than the wire we're running. A very interesting power supply method is to use an existing local area network or create a small segment of a new local area network for the CCTV system. Standard local area network wiring is 4-pair number 22. In wire size, the larger number means smaller wire. Number 22 is tiny wire. It's telephone wire. 18/2, we just mentioned, is lamp cord wire. Very good speaker wire. We're going to talk about number 10 wire later on. Number 10 wire is husky. It's power wire. It's for industrial motors. It's small enough that it's still fairly easy to work, but it's big wire. It's ordinary people big wire. It's not something you need a specialized electrician with bending tools to operate. But the sizes, number 22, number 18, and number 10. 22 is tiny little stuff, almost hair strand. 18 is reasonable lamp cord. Number 10 is big husky, ordinary people wire. Video can be transmitted through one pair of the local area network cable. Remember, there are 4 pairs making up the cable. So one pair is used for video by using a transformer that converts the coax into twisted pair. Low voltage power can be transmitted through another pair. And since there are 4 pairs there, we only need one for video, we can actually combine the 3 remaining pairs for power and get 3 number 22 wires for the plus and 3 number 22 wires for the minus. Cameras are commercially available with built-in balance so that they have a parallel twisted lead wire output rather than a coax output, and terminals for power connection. Adapters are available with BNC for video coax and telephone wire for power on one side, and an RJ45 jack for local area network on the other side. What I'm saying is the Ballon is all boxed up real tidy so that the camera power requirements go into one end, the camera video requirements go into that same end, and on the other end, you just click into your local area network. Now be careful. This is not local area network stuff. We're just using the local area network wires. You do not want a data switch at the other end of this. You want a patch panel on your end and a patch panel on the other end, and you pull it off that patch panel and start using it for security right away. You don't let the data guy start fooling with that, because you're going to zap his gadgets or he's going to zap yours. We used Ballons on a recent project. We were doing a lift bridge, and we wanted cameras on the ends, you know, where the guy drives up and stops if everything's working right, and the monitors in the control house, which was on the movable part of the bridge. We wanted the guy on the movable part of the bridge to be able to stop the bridge if it looked like somebody was going to drive into the water, you know, break down all the gates and go into the water, which they do on occasion. Lift bridges are a different story entirely. But anyway, the Ballons work great. Twisted pair, any twisted pair, works super good on local area networks because that's data-grade twisted pair. It doesn't have interference, doesn't pick up interference. Also works on, this was a control cable for the lift bridge. Worked fine on that too. So Ballons, and they cost $20. Hey, we're not talking $10,000 technology here. We're talking ordinary, we're talking contingency kind of dollars. Maybe even stuff you hid in the consumable materials. 18-2 power conductors in a Siamese cable will provide good power for a 1,000-foot run with no problem at all. Now, here's an interesting topic, and please pay attention to this because this is non-intuitive, and people will argue with you. You'll have to go to the internet to prove to them you're right. The power supply to a closed-circuit camera is simple, much more simple than commonly realized. Pelco, the largest manufacturer of cameras, security cameras, closed circuit cameras, publishes an operating voltage for one of their popular cameras of 8 to 40 volts DC. Now, they're saying it's a 12 volt DC camera. Yeah, that's a 12 volt TV camera. You hook it up at 12 volt, works fine. Hook it up to 8 volts and it works fine. Hook it up to 40 volts and it works fine. What they've done is they have a very flexible camera. Now that means that if you put a 12 volt source on it, the source that comes with it, 12 volts into the 12 volt camera, it can drop to 8 volts and still work fine. Now, why would you drop your voltage between the source and the camera? Because that's what wires do for you, especially them little piddling 22 gauge we were just talking about. There is a voltage loss on the camera. Well, how far can you go on the 22 gauge and still stay within the range? And the answer is something like 200 feet. I mean, it's a huge number to start with. Well, I want to put my camera 1,000 feet away. Well, use bigger wire. And we'll have a table farther back when we talk a little more about power supplies that says you go down to 18.2, like we were just talking about. 18.2 is over 1,000 feet. You can go to number 10 wire, and it's just unreal what you can do. The 18.2 in the Siamese has over 1,000 feet range. Now, remember, Pelco said this was an 8-volt DC to 40-volt DC camera. You call it a 12-volt camera, but it'll operate on 40 volts. Well, again, who cares? Let's put 12 volts into a 12-volt camera. No. Somebody gets this idea, I really want to run my camera 1,000 feet away. I want to put it into a local plug 1,000 feet away. And designer guy, he says, no, hook it up to my uninterruptible power source back in the control room. Let's run 1,000 feet of video cable out to it. Let's run 1,000 feet of power out to it. The guy says, no. Everybody says, no. He wants to power it locally. You'll have too much voltage drop from the control room. Well, here's what you do. You put a 40-volt power supply in the control room. Camera's happy with 40 volts. There's nothing bad about 40 volts. You can drop from 40 to 36 to 30 to 24 to 18 to 12, and we're still within the range of the camera. The bizarre thing about running it off 40 volts is you disconnect the camera and it pops up to 40 volts again. Connect the camera, it drops down to 12 volts. But the 40 volts isn't bad for the camera, and the 12 volts isn't bad for the camera, and anything in between isn't bad for the camera. Okay. For a high reliability installation, you need an uninterruptible power source for the camera, recorder, controls, and monitor. This works in favor of the Siamese cable with a power source in the same cabinet as the signal termination, that is, as the monitor and the controls and the DVR. For over 50 years, a TV camera was connected to a coaxial cable and the cable connected to a monitor. Commonly, a T connector was used on the monitor so that the signal could continue to some controls or to another monitor. And this works fine. In theory, the camera has a 75-ohm termination internally, the coax has a 75-ohm characteristic impedance, and the last monitor connected has a 75-ohm termination resistor. Many monitors have two coax connectors for loop-through operation and a dip switch for termination, where the terminator is turned on or the terminator is turned off. If it's turned on, that means there's 75-ohm termination. If it turns off, the signal goes through without being affected. In practice, however, the rules are broadly ignored and the systems still work fine. Conventional coax is RG/59. RG58 is identical to RG59, but rated 50 ohms instead of 75 ohms. It's the wrong cable, but once again, it's violated and works fine. I'm not recommending doing it wrong. I'm recommending doing it right, but I'm saying errors are tolerable in this application. It's a single shielded solid conductor with a PVC jacket. RG59 is a military designation from before World War II. For baseband video, that is 0 to 6 megahertz, the kind of thing we've been talking about, it's very, very satisfactory. Standard video signal level is 1.0 volts peak, and I'll explain to you maybe why it's not peak to peak. It's because it's not a symmetrical signal. It's not the least bit symmetrical if you've seen what these things look like. There is a DC component. You will lose the DC component over its transmission. It has to be regenerated in the monitor, but in any event, 1.0 volt is the right measure, and it's a peak voltage, not a peak to peak voltage. Video content does not radiate very far and does not cause interference to household entertainment equipment, garage door openers, or EMS radios. However, there's both a radiation and a pickup through the single shield, through the connectors, and through the terminations in the enclosures. Higher quality coax is required when the video is modulated to 100 MHz for broadband or CATV application. Different coaxial cables are illustrated below. Now, what's going on there? And this is, again, one of these terrible, confusing things that you just have to know about so that you know what people are talking about, especially when they're trying to blow smoke at you. Baseband and broadband. Baseband means the signal is the signal is the signal. Broadband means you do something to the signal so that it has other characteristics and it's easier to handle. The example we're using is baseband video, which is 0 to 6 megahertz. It's a video signal. Take it from the camera, plug it into the monitor, works. Broadband means that we pretend it's a broadcast TV signal. So instead of 0 to 6 megahertz, it's still 0 to 6 megahertz, but it's located at 100 megahertz. It's from 100 megahertz to 106 megahertz. Now, why do I say 100 megahertz? Because 100 megahertz is the middle of the broadcast TV band. I remember channel 2 through 13, I think 14 starts UHF. Well, the VHF TV band is centered around 100 megahertz. So if you modulate one camera up to a TV channel, that's called broadband. Broadband radiates. Broadband picks up. Broadband interferes with garage door openers, overflying aircraft. Broadband requires a lot more attention in the coax than baseband or video. When we talk about RG59, for years and years and years, RG59 was what they used for CATV. You're not allowed to use RG59 for CATV anymore. You have to use double-shielded coax to minimize the amount of interference you give to overflying aircraft or emergency medical equipment. And they have stories about pacemakers and stuffs in hospitals. I think a lot of the stuff is made up, but bottom line is, if you're going to go broadband, you're going to use a lot more expensive cable, more expensive termination, higher skills necessary to operate, and broadband is not the same as baseband. There are pictures in the text of what this stuff looks like. I've got a picture here of RG59 and RG11, and these relate to a table farther back. RG59 has something like 650 feet rated running length. You can run it farther, but the pictures notably deteriorate. RG11, you can run a little farther. There's another, I think it's RG6, is farther than that, but it has a very different outside diameter. It looks different. It's harder to bend. And this is part of the detailed decision if you're going to run an analog system. Belden and West Penn are names you should remember. They're the lead manufacturers of coaxial cable. Other people make fine products, but Belden and West Penn part numbers are usually used for base specifications and cross-reference to other manufacturers. A brief aside on connectors is appropriate here. For the last 50 years, the standard video connector is the BNC. This stands for something in French about bayonets, and that's the way it works. It sticks in and twists. It's different from... the N connector I've run into is about the same. It's a little tiny thing. But the BNC, this sticking and twist, it's nice. Works well, has a nice feel in your hand. They terminate nice. It's just a real nice connector. It's appropriate that it has survived in this application. And there's some pictures in here of what they look like. What do they look like? It looks like a TV connector. About the only place in the world you see them are two places. One is for TV connections, and the other is on oscilloscopes. For whatever reason, when they started making oscilloscopes, this is the plug they used for the probe on an oscilloscope. So on the front of an oscilloscope, you plug it in by twist. On the back of a TV monitor, you stick my twist. If you're thinking about the little one with all the screws, you can see on a little tiny hole in the middle, that's an F connector. There's problems with F connectors. I'm glad the cable TV people like them. I don't like them. RCA connector has a big, thick pin in the middle and kind of a raggedy-looking shell around it that makes a mechanical contact with the shield. RCA connectors used for audio commonly are notorious for bad shield connection. Except for being cheap, there's nothing good you can say about an RCA connector. BNC connector has a positive pressure on the shield, a nice connection on the center conductor. It's just a real nice connector. Oh, and the reason this is included in here with the illustrations, they cost $1.25. You know, it's not like this stuff is burning your project budget because we're using a premium connector. Yeah, we're using a premium connector. It costs $1.25. The labor to install it is certainly more than the cost of the connector. We've got a picture of a crimp BNC, a clamp BNC, a chassis BNC female, and an isolated chassis BNC female. One of the things that we're not going to discuss in this course is shielding. Shielding is a real nasty problem, especially when you get to video signals and you got problems with one interfering with the other. The manufacturers have figured out how to handle this, and it's better to leave the covers alone because that's where the shielding comes from. But coax is inherently a single-ended transmission line. It's got a signal conductor and a shield around it. And this works great. I mean, it's been there for 50 years. We've been using it for 50 years. I guarantee we'll use it for another 50 years. But it takes the ground from one end to the ground at the other end. And when you do that, lightning tries to use the shield conductor to carry lightning current from one end to the other end. And it burns up that little copper wire because it's connected to ground at both ends. And earth ground is very different at both ends when you're involved in lightning. So the ground connection at both ends is bad on coax. Now, you don't have to worry about it so much with care. You should know about this, but you don't have to worry about it on CCTV because typically you'll hang this camera up in a ceiling and there's nothing else it's connected to. If you were to screw a metal part of the camera to the building steel, then you've got a parallel lightning path and you're trying to burn out the little cable. But if you're putting it on the cardboard ceiling tile, no problem. And almost all of these cameras are in plastic mounts, so there's no metallic connection between the camera and the physical mounting. And again, there's no electrical path. But there is an inherent problem that the ground on the shield has a real high likelihood of being different than earth ground. So the guy that's plugging this in is holding the metal connector in one hand. He's got his arm wrapped around the building steel in the other hand to keep from falling off the ladder. And he can get a real nasty shock off that. So be warned, inherent disadvantage in coaxial cable and BNC connectors. The whole connector itself is at ground potential. Sounds good, except it's a different ground than the building steel. The first problem with conventional coax transmission is bundle size. A small system uses 16 cameras. 16 coax come together as the size of a baseball bat and only bend slightly more easily than a baseball bat. You will find bundles of 16 coax above the ceiling tiles in many, many stores, schools, factories, and offices. Unfortunately, these are illegal due to two changes in the National Electric Code. Article 720 specifically applies the National Electric Code to low-voltage wiring. For years and years, low-voltage guys, like the telephone guys, just said, doesn't apply to us, we're low-voltage, we don't have to do National Electric Code. Well, the National Electric Code put the words in, you will comply, and the inspectors that enforce the National Electric Code say, you will comply. Now, some of the inspectors haven't read that part, or they haven't been to a training course where it emphasizes that part, but the rule is clear, and it is very generally enforced now, that the National Electric Code, all of those nitpicking little rules, apply to coax for TV systems. Article 720 specifically applies the NEC to low-voltage wiring. 725.6 requires hangers. You don't lay the cable on the ceiling tile. The reasoning is, if there's smoke coming from the ceiling tile, the fireman wants to get in there, see what's going on, squirt something on it, or do what firemen do. And if you got a bunch of cables, and I've been in offices like this, it's very, very common. There's so many cables on the ceiling tile, you can't move the ceiling tile. And if you do, you get to see all the cables up there. You don't get to see what's going on in there. Well, that's illegal. It must be easy for the fireman to get into the ceiling space, above ceiling space. And you want it easy for the maintenance guy to go up there if there's a leaking pipe or if there's an electrical problem. I mean, it's just bad to lay the cables on the tile, even though that's what you'll see in every existing building you go into. Article 725.61 requires plenum rated cables in above ceiling areas used for HVAC returns. Now, is this important to us? Yeah, we don't want anybody dying. I mean, that's what this is about. If there is a fire in the above ceiling space, we're not saying that the closed circuit camera catches fire. Anything at all catches fire. Conventional PVC makes a toxic gas and kills people. We don't want to kill people. So the rule is, if the airspace above the drop ceiling is part of the HVAC system, so toxic fumes will be circulated around into the populated spaces, then it has to be plenum rated cable. Plenum rated means fireproof. It costs about twice as much as non-plenum. Let me think of some numbers here. I'm thinking 100 and 400, so maybe it's four times as much. I'm thinking that 1,000 feet of Cat 5 cable, good local area network cable, costs about $100, and it's about $400 for plenum rated, so it may be four times as much. It's definitely more expensive, and the contractor will not offer to run plenum cable unless he's the guy that has to deal with the inspector. And again, the way these projects come together, usually the building's up and populated, and you come back and put the security into it, so the inspector never sees the installation. So you can have a situation setting you up to kill somebody, and nobody has inspected it, and somebody along the way saved a few $100s. That adds up to thousands of dollars, and somebody else died. Cable tray is another way to distribute cable, and very appropriate for very large bundles of coax. Cable tray is not discussed in this course. Small bundle hangers are cable rings. They're things from a half inch maybe to 2 inches as a diameter. It's a little ring, and usually they're screw mount. I have seen some drive rings where you drive them into a wood surface. Screw can be a wood screw, so you screw it into a wood surface, or a machine screw, so you screw it into a special adapter. A special adapter would be like a beam clamp. Beam clamp costs a dollar. It's a thing that tightens down to the building steel that's holding the roof up, and then you screw this bridle ring into it, or cable ring, and then when you run the cable through the bridle rings. This is legal. This is what the National Electric Code is talking about, and there are pictures of these in the written version of the course. Another alternative is J-hooks. J-hooks look like what they look like. They're maybe 2 inches or 3 inches across with an end sticking out that you mount. You mount it to the wall, or you mount it to some building steel, and all kinds of adapters for different things you can mount it to. But a J-hook will carry a fairly large bundle of cables. And the nice thing about a J-hook is that it's very easy to lay the cable into afterwards. Some people like to pull 20 cables at the same time. Nothing wrong with pulling 20 cables. Gets real hard to pull it through bridle rings because all of the cables have to go through the first one, all the cables have to go through the second one, all the cables have to go through the third one. And that end with the 20 cables going through at the same time, it's hard to slip through the bridle ring. Since you're laying it into the J-hook, you can pull it across the drop ceiling and then drop it into the J-hook. It's all out of the way, it's all legal, and it's much, much easier to do. Another way to support this is something called Caddy Tracks. Caddy is a brand name of Ericsson. They're a really good manufacturer of an awful lot of materials, including cable support hardware. And if this is a subject of interest to you, make sure you go to the Errico website and see what they've got, or check with the Errico rep around you. There's a Caddy Cat Tracks that I found on the internet. This is just a real sweet product. Mounts off a beam clamp like the other stuff, hangs down to a big hook, like a J-hook, but really a big thing. Then it's got some plastic mesh underneath it. And when you're done, it's just a real, real attractive installation. Probably not cheap, but on the other hand, if you start looking at the labor involved in running a bundle of cables, you can spend a lot of money on the supports if you can reduce the labor. You can use your labor savings to buy more attractive technology that you're going to be looking at for the next 20 years of the life of the system. And again, this Caddy Cat Track stuff looks like something I'd be real happy to run more cables into at a later time. Something like bridle rings, you can have a lot of trouble trying to put more cables into it at a later time. A very attractive alternative signal transmission scheme uses a balancing transformer called a balun on each end. The coax is converted to twisted pair, then back to coax. This works very well, but is not sufficiently common to be readily recognized by most technicians. Guy goes up there to work on the CCTV system, he's not going to realize that that LAN cable is really the CCTV, and unless he's had special training or been talked to by his foreman before he goes to work on it. A few cameras have internal balance. None have been encountered with integral RJ45 connectors to use the LAN wiring without an adapter. Video can be converted to fiber optic easily. You buy what's called a black box. I just love that name. Made by the Black Box Corporation. They put interesting things in little boxes, and that's why they call them black boxes, and that's why they call their company Black Box. Fiber optic converters is something nice you can get in a black box, and there are a bunch of other people that sell them too. But you put video in on one side, fiber optic comes out the other side, and of course 12 volts or something to operate the thing. Works very well with single cameras. Like if you really want to have a camera out on the other end of your parking lot, and there are a lot of reasons you would want another camera out on the other end of the parking lot, running a fiber optic cable and power is easy, and it works, and it works very, very well. And by the way, Siamese is available with fiber optic in it and the 18-2 power on the outside of it. Very complicated, or at least more complicated, for multiple cameras. You got to modulate the cameras in some kind of multiplexed form. I call it up converting because usually it's very high frequencies on fiber optic, and then you got to down convert it back to video at the other end. There's nothing on the market that I'm aware of that uses fiber optic as a direct input, so you have to go into fiber optic, come out of fiber optic. And these are $100 boxes from Black Box. I mean, it's not like it's a big deal. It's just that it gets costly. You want four cameras out there, then you got to run four strands of coax or an up converter, and make your own decision. The technology is out there, and it works, and it works very well. Fiber optic, I call it complicated, fragile, and expensive, and that's probably wrong. It is not complicated for a guy who's done a dozen previous installations. Very, very complicated for a guy who's never done it before. Fiber optic is very sensitive to bending radius. You've got to run the cable properly, or you have problems with your cable. Fragile, again, to a guy who's done 12 systems, it's not fragile, and it's not hard to work with. To a guy doing it the first time, you absolutely don't want to hire a guy to do it the first time. Let him practice at the technician school or the apprenticeship program. Don't let him practice on your project. Expensive? No, if you're talking 1,000 feet away, it's easy to spend a lot more money repairing the parking lot than on the cable that you put in your direct burial or in your conduit. Today, it is common to convert coax to IP packets and distribute them over a local area network using data switches and equipment and the internet. Data to fiber optic converters cost the same as video to fiber converters, but carry 16 or 32 or 64 cameras. The signal is usually not converted back to coax at the control room. Rather, it's recorded digitally on a hard disk and DVD and viewed on PC screens. Internet Wi-Fi IPTV cameras are being sold for $300 to $2,000. They work with an installed Wi-Fi access point and make the image available to anyone with an internet connection and password. However, Wi-Fi has an inherent security breach in being continuously on the air. Using instructions available from the internet, anyone can sit down with a Wi-Fi laptop in the parking lot and work at his leisure to catch the password when someone is accessing an image. He can work at guessing the password or simply watch the images that the legitimate user has accessed. Also, the newer cellular phones deliver IP images. That's not Wi-Fi, but it's the way IPTV is growing. Personal digital assistants with Wi-Fi can deliver IPTV. This concludes Session 2. Please join us for Session 3, where we'll discuss a little bit more about cameras, but outside the box in this case, the enclosure on the camera, pan, tilt, zoom, and sound.